expenditure is called to order. It's about 1:05, and it's March the 4th. We have three things on the agenda today. We have House Bill 107, which we heard before by Representative Ramos regarding hunting and fishing interference. We're going to bring that back. We have some new ideas about how to fix that. We have House Bill 175 by myself, the Civil Legal Services Fund, and then we have what I think will take the bulk of the time today, House Bill 95, Public Health Disasters and Emergencies. It's my intent to bring the bill up, have some good discussion on it, and then bring it back again on Monday to give people some time to think about it and make sure they've got their changes in that they want. Representative Kira.
Thanks, Madam Chair. On the third bill, the public health one, we're going to need some help drafting some changes to the bill, and I wonder whether we might have somebody from legislative legal here to sort of listen to the discussion and help us with changes.
There are a series of amendments already drafted by legislative legal.
Okay, who's the drafter, Vanessa? Is it Michelle?
Michelle.
Do you think you could place a phone call and see if she'd be willing to join us about, I would say, like 1:30, 1:45? Okay, and so present for the record are Representatives Gira, Coghill, Dahlstrom, and myself, McGuire. We do have a quorum to conduct business, and we have House Bill 107. Mr. Pound.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, good members of the committee. Again, Representative Ramos is still working on the University Lands Bill and Resources.
Glad we're not there.
I believe it actually skipped your committee, so you may be lucky on that one. After our discussion on Wednesday, I took some time and spoke with Representative Gruenberg and Representative Guerra and Representative Coghill regarding concerns that they had expressed on Wednesday, and I believe we have worked out an agreement in reference to Representative Gruenberg's concern about the law enforcement issue as it was essentially designed to make it an affirmative defense. We simply took that and moved it into the D section, which discusses affirmative defenses for law enforcement. The second concern was so that it wouldn't be totally profitable for someone that we've changed it so that prevailing party is able to recoup all costs and 90% of reasonable actual attorney fees. And that also, as a result of doing that, allowed us to delete Rule 79 from the indirect court rule changes.
Fantastic. So I need a motion to adopt the new CS before us, version L. Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you. I would move the CS for House Bill 107, version L.
Okay. The motion to adopt that version, version L, is there any objection to adopting it? Okay. Hearing none. Is there any further discussion on the part of the committee on the new CS that we have before us or any further debate? Okay.
No, I just
Representative Kira.
Oh, thanks. I just appreciate the sponsor working with us on the bill. And thanks.
Representative Coghill.
I also appreciate, I'm not going to hold the bill up, but I still have a question. And I will continue to work with the sponsor on finding an answer to that question because it's in statute now and it's an amendment here. The physically interfering with and tampering with has got several issues to it. Two of them are licensed issues, and one of them is not. And so I think you're penalizing that is going to be very difficult to quantify. I'm going to do a little bit of search on some precedents that have been set, if at all. And so, not to hold up the bill, but I do have a question on it because I'd like to feel some comfort in it. And I'm also looking for other answers on how do we deal with viewing in Alaska in a larger scale anyway. You know, obviously, Alaska is one place that a lot of people in the world pay a lot of money to come here to view. And I'm just wondering if we get disturbed by it or they get disturbed by it, what are we talking about? I really don't know the answer to that. And so, just as a commitment to the sponsor and the committee, I will be following this and we'll try to get some comfort in that area as well.
Hey, Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move the CS for House Bill 107, version L, with attached physical note and zero and individual recommendations.
Okay, is there any objection to that motion? And there's one other indeterminate. And so, hearing no objection, CS.
That should be a zero now on law.
There is. They haven't updated it.
Yeah, updated zero. Okay. So CS for House Bill number 107, version L, with individual recommendations and zero fiscal notes. We'll move out of this committee.
Thank you,
Mr. Pound.
Chair, member of the committee.
Okay. That brings us to the next item on the agenda, House Bill number 175. And the CS needs adopting.
Chair, I move the CS for House Bill 175, version G.
Okay. Motion to adopt version G. Everybody has that in front of them. Is there any objection to adopting that version? Okay, hearing none, we have our trusted committee counsel, Vanessa Tondini, to tell you why you better vote for this bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's so nice not having the cameras here.
Oh, isn't it great? It's relaxing.
Goodness.
We can arrange that.
Well, thank you very much for hearing this bill. I'm testifying on behalf of the sponsor, the lovely Chair McGuire. And this is...
The video's not here.
Pushing it.
The tape is on, but the video's not here.
Nobody listens. Well, this bill, in Representative Coghill's favorite word, financial mechanism, it's designed to provide a financial mechanism whereby the legislature may make appropriations to organizations that provide civil legal services to low-income Alaskans. And... I don't know, most of you might already know that currently Alaska Statute 0917-020J provides that 50% of punitive damages awards in tort cases go into the general fund. And so this bill would establish a civil legal services fund into which the legislature may appropriate these monies into. And it then allows the legislature to appropriate money from the fund to organizations that provide civil legal services for these low-income Alaskans. And it's important to note it doesn't create a mandatory expenditure. Each legislature has the option to appropriate these monies into the fund if established. And the bill also defines low income as equal to or less than the maximum income levels for Alaska as determined under 45 CFR Part 1611. And that was one change encompassed in the CS. And I also included an email in your bill packet which explains why it's just better to reference.
Could you explain what the change was again?
One of the changes is referencing defining low-income individual means an individual with an income equal to or less than the maximum income level for Alaska determined under the federal regulation 45 CFR.
I see.
Part 16. And in the previous version, I believe it was just as determined by the Legal Services Corporation. And I have printed out, if you want to see that regulation, I can make copies and distribute. It's kind of interesting how they determine it. But anyway, so that's one of the changes, and I'll explain the other change in the CS in a second. But basically, the Alaska Legal Services Corporation, I believe there should be someone online from there if you have specific questions from their organization, but they were created in 1966, and they have just assisted low-income Alaskans with their civil legal needs. And they're not a state agency. They're a nonprofit entity. And they've been funded through a combination of state, federal, and private sources. And as most of you know, over the last several years, these funds have been on the decline. And so the inherent logic behind this bill was that the funds that we can assist their organization and others like theirs work to keep them going and to provide the services they do, it makes sense that civil lawsuits that in which these punitive damages awards come out of can be used to fund cases which are no less important but to help out low-income Alaskans. So why is this bill so important and such a great idea? Well, no one would disagree that low-income Alaskans have the same legal needs that everyone else does. They shouldn't have to have the burden of representing themselves unless they so choose to. This bill gives them greater access to legal services, and it addresses the current inadequate funding structure of organizations that provide these legal services, and it provides for these services using punitive damages awards for egregious offenses rather than draining other sources of funding. So, and then the other change, just to note, in the CS was brought about with the Alaska Legal Services Corporation, conversation they had with Department of Law, their only concern was that any cost of collection that the state might incur with respect to the punitive damages awards should come out of the proceeds before they were put into the Civil Legal Services Fund, to not act as a disincentive for the Department of Law to create the fund. So you'll note on lines 9 and 10 of the bill, it just says less the cost of collection, if any, incurred by the state. So anyway, thank you very much, and I'll entertain any questions. And we also have Art Peterson here, who's more brilliant than myself.
Fantastic. And just one other point for members of this committee in particular. One of the other reasons that I was moved to sponsor it is the fact that when low-income civil litigants choose to represent themselves pro se, which is the only option you have if you don't have an attorney, it ends up costing all of us in the end. And so you've got judges put in the position of a very awkward position of sort of advising when they shouldn't be. You have pro se defendants trying to work their way through the legal system at great cost to the courts and so on. And so there's a fiscal note to that that we don't see. And this is one mechanism of helping to fund this organization that leads these folks into the legal process, which, frankly, as we all know, is very confusing. And the stakes are high for many people. It's evictions. It's their home. It's the place they live. It's their livelihood in many cases. So I just wanted to add those comments. And Representative Gruenberg.
A couple of questions. Thank you, Madam Chair. With respect to punitive damages, it states somewhere in here that half the award goes to the state.
917-020J.
020J. Okay. Okay, now, with respect to that, it says 50% of the award goes into the general fund of the state. Does that include the award of attorney's fees? No. Okay, Mr. Peterson is saying no. Just the punies.
Through the chair, okay. Representative Gruenberg.
Okay. Second question. With respect to less the cost of collection, if any, incurred by the state, in collecting the punitive damages, the portion that's awarded to the state, would not the state normally just have the plaintiff's attorney do the collection, and then the net proceeds would be split, or does the state itself do it? Because if, in fact, the state is not doing the cost of collection in a given case, I would say it should be less the cost of collection.
I don't think Vanessa knows exactly how it plays out, but we've got Art Peterson here and Andy Harrington from Alaska Legal Services, so we'll have them answer.
Sure.
Representative Kerr.
I think I can answer that question. The amount of money that would be deducted would be the amount of money the state expends in going after the private counsel and saying there was an attorney's fee recovery, we should get half of it. Sometimes there are negotiations that go on in order for the state to get its share. And so the attorney general will spend some time doing that. I think the bill sponsors need to do this to make sure that they don't incur any additional fiscal obligation to the state so that we don't have a fiscal note.
But I understand that through the chair. My concern was, let us say that there's $1 million awarded in punitives, and half of that would go to the state. I assume what this means is if you have to do a writ of execution and the stuff that you were just saying, that goes on. But let's assume that there are judgment debtor examinations and they have to track people down and set aside fraudulent conveyances and all that kind of stuff which can occur. But the person that's doing the work is actually the plaintiff's attorney. Will this cover that?
No. Through the chair?
Yes.
It says the costs incurred by the state. So if those costs are incurred by a private attorney, then they wouldn't be deducted.
Should they not be deducted, too? Because it's the cost of it should be the net amount of 50, the net that goes in. No, you're shaking your head now.
I think that's a different...
Representative Gere.
That's a different question. The first question is, what does this bill do? This bill says that the state can deduct its collection costs. The second question you raise is, when the former, when the law that's on the books already says that 50% of the punitive damages recoveries go to the state, should that be 50% net of the plaintiff's attempts to recover the money? So you're right. I don't know the answer to that question, but that would require a change to a different statute.
No, but I Art Peterson was. Maybe we should get Mr. Peterson up here. He was nodding and shaking. Maybe.
So we've got just three people to testify. Time. We'll have Art Peterson, who's here, come forward.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. I'm Art Peterson, recently retired attorney, and about to be retired 31-year member of the Alaska Legal Services Board of Directors. A week from tomorrow will be my last meeting after 31. I agree with almost everything that was said, except for Representative Gruenberg's comment, or question actually, about the private collection expenses. And when the punitive damages award goes into the general fund under that other statute that Ms. Tondini cited, and she did an excellent job, by the way.
She's good.
That's a separate matter. Once the money is in the pot, then the only consideration, the fiscal consideration, as I understand Representative Coghill is concerned about especially, is what the state has to do to get the money in the pot. And now we've created this little sub-pot that allows for the percentage to go to this public purpose. So if there is state expense in collecting that, well then maybe it makes sense to deduct that. But any other areas outside that, any private collection, the contest between attorneys and so on by a private practitioner, that's not relevant to what the state is involved in putting the money in the pot or taking this percentage out and providing it for this legal services public purpose. I, needless to say, am testifying in support of the bill, and I wanted to thank the chair for introducing the bill and thank the chair for her comments earlier just now about the reasons for the bill. Excellent statement. As many of you know, Alaska Legal Services at one time received $1.2 million from the state alone back in the early 80s. And we had 14 offices around the state, fairly comprehensively serving rural Alaska as well as municipal and high population Alaska. We had something like 93 or 97 employees. Now we're down to 8 offices, one of which is part-time with a paralegal, and that's the Ketchikan office. We've had to sometimes open and close offices because of the erratic state funding. In recent years, it's been about $125,000 from the state. Last year, the legislature cut that in half for some reason. I mean, the cases didn't get less or fewer. People didn't get any kinder to each other. There were still issues out there. Poor people still had legal problems. But anyway, the legislature cut it, and then, on top of that, the governor came along and zeroed it out with his line item veto. And one of the things I read that just floored me was the governor's statement to the effect that providing legal services was not a state function, as though the state were not obligated to provide equal access to all the people of the state. I just could not comprehend that rationale, but that's perhaps a slightly tangential issue. This bill will provide one little step in helping us secure a source of funding. My dream is to get our endowment fund up to a level that would enable us to be self-sustaining. We wouldn't have to worry about state or federal funding. I have talked with the Gates Foundation folks, and they said, well, send in your application and we'll consider it and so on. So that's one source, but whether that will ever come to be, you know, this at this moment, just a dream. We need the regular appropriation from the state, and we need this bill. ALSA provides efficiency. The attorneys there work for a fraction of what they would get in the private sector. We start our attorneys at something like $30,000. And, excuse me, one of our staff members is a Harvard, it's either magna cum laude or summa cum laude law school graduate. He could be, he's been out, I don't know, 15 or 20 years by now, probably be earning close to $1 million a year in the corporate world or the banking investment world, and he's working for something like $50,000. Because of dedication to the principle of equal access to justice, and our staff, the attorneys, the clerks, secretaries, put in huge amounts of overtime, again, because they're dedicated to the principle of equal access. So it's a program that provides the biggest bang for the buck. You get more work, more service out of any money that goes into Alaska Legal Services than any other program I've been aware of, and I've been involved with state government for 38 years now here. So I wanted to thank you for considering this bill, and I trust you'll be considering it favorably, given that it's the chair's bill. And as the chair also mentioned, it helps judges and helps everyone else involved with the legal system, because when judges have to try to help one side of a case because that person doesn't have an attorney, doesn't know the procedure, is overwhelmed by the whole process, that slows things down enormously. And in one instance, just one personal little anecdote, if I may, I represented the legislature a few years back, and there was a suit against the legislature by a person not represented by an attorney, and that person could not believe that the attorney on the other side, so not representing the legislature, would try to deal fairly with that person. And that really complicated the matter. Finally, a pro bono attorney got involved in the case on that side of the case. And while, of course, it, you know, provided me with a worthy combatant, so to speak, it made things go so much more smoothly. So we need this for the benefit of everybody involved in the court system. And the amendments to the bill that you've now adopted, the committee substitute, I'm not intimately familiar with the accounting and bookkeeping aspects of how the money goes in and then the costs of collection are deducted and all of that. There are people around who can tell you about that. But it looks like a reasonable amendment, and certainly the citation of the federal regulation that provides for the Alaska poverty level is a reasonable amendment. So I would support the committee substitute and would try to answer any questions the committee might have.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Representative Coghill and then Guerra.
First of all, thank you for 38 years. That's commendable, and I hope the next chapter is a real adventure for you, or a good adventure, I should say.
Thank you.
In looking at this 09-17-020J, which is going to be the punitive part, can you give me some concept from your personal experience of what that might look like? Because I have not been a part of that system at all, but it would be helpful to me to understand what generally we're looking at under that statute.
Through the chair, Representative Coghill, no. I can't, because
those are questions I'll be asking, Madam Chair. I was just hoping that maybe from his perspective, as he's seen punitive damages required, that we would know.
Interestingly, in my 38 years of practice in Alaska, I have never handled a case out of, you know, hundreds of cases that involve punitive damages. But it appears that Representative Guerra is more familiar with it than I, and perhaps could provide some help with that.
Representative Guerra.
Well, there's one other question, Madam Chair, and then we can get to Representative Guerra, which I'm anxiously waiting.
That's good information on it.
The other thing is, when in legal services, one of the things that you do probably is examine at what level they can afford to or not afford to get legal services. And are you familiar with 45 CFR 1611?
I have read it many times. I could not quote it, but yeah.
Is that a criteria that is already in practice?
Yes. It is. It's been there for a long time. In Alaska, it sets the level at 125% of the Department of Health and Human Services poverty guideline. And once the person is under that level, they're eligible. Then they have to go through the case priority screening. The board does not get involved, board of directors does not get involved in individual cases, but we set policy and we set the priorities, type of cases and that sort of thing. So then the person has to go through that screening, and if they meet both of those criteria, then it's a workload management type of problem. But yes, there are layers.
We do also have Andy Harrington on the line, too.
That's probably a sticking point, but I'll get back to it.
Okay. Representative Guerra.
First of all, I think I'll give Representative Coghill at least the answers that I have on how much ends up in this fund. I don't think very much ends up in the fund. I think it's pretty inconsistent, but it's a very small percentage of cases that ever involve punitive damages, contrary to sort of the popular perception. And just for those of you who don't know, you get punitive damages in a civil case if, in addition to the party that hurt you doing something wrong, they did it in a way that involved reckless disregard of your interest and safety. And so that's a high standard, and it doesn't happen that often. And then often you'll get a punitive damages award, and then the judge will take it away before it goes up to the appeals court. And in the end, it's just not that often, though it is sometimes. And in my experience was we would get them, and then we would lose them on appeal, or the judge would take it away before it went up on appeal. So, but sometimes you would get them. So I don't know what the annual average amount is that goes into that fund. I suspect it's not that much. Art, how long did you work at the Attorney General's office?
17 years through the chair.
I guess I also wanted to say thank you. In as long as I've known you, and periodically we used to send when we needed a regulation written, if the governor needed a regulation written, they'd send it to Art at the Attorney General's office. And regardless of what the regulation was, Art would do it, and he wouldn't sort of share his politics. He'd pull his punches, and he would just do what he was asked. And when he's come to this committee, he's actually been always sort of kept his politics close to his chest and pulled all his punches. And so, frankly, today when you shared your passions about legal aid for the poor, I thought it was completely appropriate. And I thought it was especially appropriate because in all the years I've ever known you, you've never done that. And I think you're entitled to every once in a while, and especially here. And plus, I agree with you. So, but it was actually surprising for me to hear because you've always been completely dispassionate about these things, and so I appreciate it. I guess I have a question for you. And Representative McGuire and I talked about this because we are trying to find a way to fund legal services. And I'm wondering if, and this might be a separate bill, it might be a committee bill if people are interested. When somebody wins a civil case, they get 20% of their attorney's fees. That's the court rule. That's the normal court rule. And so Representative McGuire and I talked about this. What about if legal services won a case, if we had a provision that said, if it's a legal services case and you're representing an indigent person, legal services is entitled to 100% of their attorney's fees? And that might help them bring in the funds that they could then use to help fund their services in the future. And right now they're getting 20%, but if they got 100%, what would you think about that?
Madam Chair, Representative Guerra, unfortunately, there is a federal, again, I can't believe it, there's more passion for you, prohibition now on legal services getting attorney fees. The ones that we are now collecting are for cases that were started before that prohibition went into effect in roughly 1997, I think, or somewhere in there anyway. It's really outrageous, because the other side, when they win, they can get them. But if we win, we can't get attorney fees anymore. The rationale behind that one is a mystery to me, too. If I could comment on a passion, and thank you for your comments. I hadn't really thought of the concept of equal access to justice as being necessarily a liberal or conservative issue. Now, maybe some people feel that liberals are more compassionate. You know, the first George Bush said he's going to have these more compassionate, I forget the phrase, I'm sorry. But anyway, it's a matter of doing justice for everybody. And it shouldn't be a legal versus conservative issue. So I've been working on that for years. Thank you.
Sure.
And actually, and I agree with you, and actually there's quite a few numbers of people on both sides of the party, I think, who agree with you on that.
Right. I've seen that, yes.
This is a question for the committees. Is that the only other straw I can grasp for would be, I guess we can think about this and talk about this later, but maybe if we end up agreeing with Mr. Peterson that there should be some state role in supporting legal services at what maybe last year's level was, or the prior year's level was, maybe a committee letter to the Finance Committee suggesting it would be useful. But that won't work unless we all decide to do it. So there.
Food for thought. Food for thought. I sure appreciate your comment. I think, I don't know that I can shed light on all of the discussion that's gone on with Alaska Legal Services, but what I could say would be that I think there are some people, Republicans and Democrats, who, when it comes to providing services for poor people, the question that always arises is, are you there, are you in that place of being poor for the right reasons? And that's a very difficult analysis. In other words, many people, my good friend to my right, have been left in pretty unbelievable circumstances in their life that they've worked their way out of through pure blood, sweat, and tears, and arrived at a place where if she had a dispute with somebody, she would, through all of that work, pay somebody to help represent her. And that's in the back of some people's minds. And I'm just trying to share with you, since we got off on this tangent, just so that you know, it's not necessarily about bad people with bad ideas. I think it's kind of the place that you come from in the world. And why I'm so moved by it is that I still also believe that there are many, many low-income people who are not there by their own choice. And they're there because they're mentally ill. They're there because they have been had a series of maybe even bad luck, bad things that they just can't seem to get ahead of. And I don't think that putting them in the legal system without somebody on their side is a good goal for anybody. And I don't think in the end, even if you want to look at it from a fiscal conservative side of the aisle, that it benefits anybody from that point either. It costs everybody a lot, and in the end, it's a good goal. But I just wanted to share with you that I do think that some members and even this governor are in this place where they're trying to decide what are those fundamental roles that the government ought to play, those fundamental services, and what is considered a fundamental service to one person is absolutely not to another. And so those are just kind of the thoughts, I guess, that I have.
Could I add a thought?
Yes.
I don't want to prolong this. I know there are other people waiting to testify on other measures, but one of the things that I think is really important to bear in mind, that many of us really lucked out. We had parents who gave us some pretty good genes. They gave us a pretty reasonable IQ that enabled us to do a heck of a lot of good things with that IQ, with that gray matter. A lot of people in this world haven't had that luck. That's one. Second area of luck, many of us have had background situations, family or friends or whatever, that gave us the kind of support, the kind of training, the kind of emotional support, as well as mental activity that gave us whatever, that determination. I'm not sure with what Representative Dahlstrom's situation was, but you know, that determination to fight our way out of some problem. A lot of people have not had that element of luck. Some of us have had pretty good financial circumstances, so we're able to pursue things and get ourselves in a position to enable us to fight. Some of us have not had that kind of luck. So luck plays a huge amount of a role in this world, and many people have not had it. And for whatever reason, whether it's simple lack of gray matter, emotional problems, lack of finances, lack of good luck, they need our help. And we need to be sensitive to that situation. And if I could mention one book that was really significant to me, back when I was in, so about the time I was in law school, I think, in the early 60s, was Michael Harrington's The Other America. And it's subtitled Poverty in the United States, or Poverty in America, or something like that. And The Other America is this percentage of the population that many of us never see. We don't come into contact with them. Nowadays, we see more homeless on the streets. We see people with the signs, you know, help me and my baby, and things like that. So we see a little bit of it now. In those days, we weren't seeing that so much, but it was still there. The housing projects in the city of Chicago, which were just very difficult places. The insights that Michael Harrington brought to me were just amazing and have stuck with me ever since. So I strongly recommend that book. I had occasion to mention it a few months ago, so I know that it was a 1963 publication. Penguin Books is the little paperback version. It's probably out of print by now, but you could probably find it in the library. But it is really a book that provides insight. Oh my gosh, you read it and just page after page. Oh geez, you know, I never thought of that. Oh, I never understood that. And that book had a lot of influence on why I put 31 years into Alaska Legal Services and 38 years into public service in the state of Alaska.
Well, I thank you, Art, and thank you for your service. I hope you'll stick around in some other capacity. Maybe we can have you testify. I would be sad to see that. You've been testifying before this committee since I was the aide to this committee, where Vanessa is. So I appreciate your hard work.
Well, one other bit of history. I was the first professional staffer to a committee in Alaska, and that was to this committee, House Judiciary. So then if you can imagine, 1 year I did both House Judiciary and Senate Judiciary.
Oh, geez. Now we don't even get along.
But that was only 1 year that time.
Thank you,
Art. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee.
We appreciate it. Okay, next I have, I only have two more people, Andy Harrington from Alaska Legal Services. Andy, are you there?
Yes, I am, Madam Chair. Thank you. Should I go ahead?
Yes, you should.
I'm the Executive Director of Alaska Legal Services. I'll apologize in advance that my larynx is not working too well this afternoon, so that's my bad luck, maybe your good luck.
No, I've got the same problem, so.
Okay. It sounds as though most of you are familiar with Alaska Legal Services Corporation, so I won't go into my thumbnail sketch organization unless it would be helpful to somebody. We are very cost-effective. We recruit volunteer attorneys through our successful pro bono volunteer attorney support program, which handles about 100, between 100 and 200 of our cases in one time. We make legal information available to the general public through a series of clinics offered by our staff and volunteer attorneys and through our Alaska Law Help website. We're not a state agency, we're not the public defenders or the Office of Public Advocacy. We don't represent people who've been charged with a crime. We only provide attorneys in cases where the law doesn't recognize the right to an appointed attorney. But the consequences in these civil cases for the family can be just as significant. For example, loss of family shelter or garnishment of the wage earner's income, or loss of health care coverage, or jeopardizing of the right to be free from domestic violence. We do have, our eligibility is set at 125% of the poverty ceiling for Alaska. For one person, that figure is about $14,500 per year. For a household of two, it goes up to about $19,500, and so on with each additional person. Our mission is to provide meaningful access to justice in resolving civil legal problems for low-income clients, thus promoting family stability and reducing the legal consequences of poverty. This bill stems in some respect from the last Supreme Court Task Force report issued in May of 2000. It does turn out, as the chair eloquently pointed out, that providing representation to low-income clients helps the court system function more efficiently for everyone, including judges and other litigants. A civil case in which one or both people are unrepresented takes more time and attention from the judge and increases the chances that the judge's decision will be based on incomplete information. I wanted to talk just briefly about two kind of typical cases, one out of Anchorage and one out of North Pole. The case out of Anchorage, a woman came to our office in December having just lost an eviction hearing, a forcible entry detainer. It's very difficult to get the court to visit those, but in this case, the young staff attorney who took this case on dug into the matter and found out that the woman was currently renting the home, but up until a few months ago, had owned it. It had been foreclosed because she had entered into one of those too-good-to-be-true refinancing arrangements with an outside firm. And especially when the actual terms of that came to light, she lost out the foreclosures. Now, Alaska law, in fact, gave her significantly more protection than she had been given in this process. So after the two all-nighters, the attorney on Monday morning filed a case after short time. Short before the hearing, the attorneys from the other side made a generous settlement offer, and as a result, the eviction was set aside. The woman recovered not only possession of, but also her ownership interest in the house, and in addition got about $11,000 in a settlement proceeding, all without the judge having to make a ruling. This was, of course, the fact that it occurred just before Christmas made it all the more heartening for the family. The second case involved an elderly couple out of North Pole. I raised this kind of in the context of the good luck, bad luck discussion that came up. This couple was, they were not well-to-do, but they were getting by all right when the fellow suffered a severe fracture of his leg, and beyond at the local hospital to be able to provide surgery that he needed, he had to be flown outside. He found that taking a medevac plane would cost, I don't know, $20,000 to $25,000, something in that range. But the Alaska Airlines could get him down there for, if you were to buy three seats, could get him down there for about a third of the cost, somewhere around $7,000 to $8,000. And so he exercised, I think, the same judgment of court exercise of the circumstances, which was to say, let me take the less expensive option. By doing so, he found out that Medicare, the federal health insurance program, refused to reimburse him for the $8,000 ticket, even though they acknowledged they would have been more than willing to pay for the $25,000 medevac.
Isn't that
We took that case through an administrative hearing. I mean, it offended me not only that my client wasn't getting this money back, but also that he was being penalized for having made exactly the sort of decision that I think Alaskan citizens are likely to make all the time. And eventually we did get a favorable ruling from the administrative law judge who saw that logic, and the fellow was able to get reimbursed for that cost. Sometimes it's bad luck. Sometimes it's just the fact that you make what looks like a good decision, and the bureaucracies that we all have to deal with just don't recognize it as such. On the criminal side, the legislature has admirably maintained its commitment for equal justice. The prosecutors are paid by the state public defender's office. The Office of Justice Rights, we're very supportive of. On the civil side, the fiscal realities the legislature has had to deal with have kind of forced us to erode our support for equal justice on the civil cases. This bill represents a creative approach to try to bolster that commitment, to take the proceeds from these kind of high-stake monetary cases and use that as a way of bolstering equal access to justice by families who deserve equal access to justice. And we're very appreciative, both from the hearing and from the chair's action introducing this bill. And I'd be happy to answer any questions that we may have. I do have a little bit of information, I think, some approximate figures on the amount. And I can talk a little more about the restrictions. That would be helpful.
Thank you, Andy. And Representative Coghill wants to know what the weather's like there today.
It's a pretty nice day up here, Representative Coghill. It's not quite above freezing, and the sun is shining, and so it'd be a nice day for you to be up here, if you can think of that.
Heat wave.
Couldn't agree with you more. It'd be a nice day to be up there.
Thank you, Andy. Any questions?
He did say, Madam Chair,
that
you give us an idea on punitive amounts, and so I would be interested in what his view of that world is.
Did you hear the question, Andy?
Yes, I did. Thank you. Through the Chair, Representative Coghill, what we have been told is that for the fiscal year that was completed, and I'm using the approximate amount, but I think there was about 150 to 175,000 that had come to the state under 09.17.020J. And then in the most recent fiscal year, the amount had been, I think, somewhere between $300,000 and $400,000 that had come in. We're anticipating that it's going to be kind of a roller coaster ride. There are probably going to be most years when little or no money comes into this fund. As Representative Garra pointed out, neither the plaintiff nor the defendant has a particular incentive to settle for punitive damages, and most civil cases are resolved by settlement. So it'll be an exception to the rule when there are punitive damages at all, and very much an exception when there is a large punitive damage award. But those are the amounts that I was told that had been coming into the state from that source in the two most recent years.
Gotcha. Representative Acosta.
And what would you say, Andy, that the cost of collection might be on those? Have you got any idea on that?
I do not. This came up from a discussion that I had with Acting Attorney General Scott Nordstrand, and he didn't have figures in front of him when he was talking about this either, but he said that there were some situations in which the state was having to take some step to protect its interest in those awards. And he said he didn't think it would be much, but he thought that maybe in the neighborhood of $10,000 to $20,000 worth of attorney time might have gone into that on the part of the department. We did talk about whether he would prefer kind of having some sort of an administrative fee of 3% or 4% or something, or whether he would prefer having his attorneys keep track of any time they put in on these particular tasks. And he said he thought that to avoid overestimating or underestimating, his attorneys are very used to keeping track of their time individually, so he would just have them chalk their time up to that particular account, and that was what that was the preference that he expressed, and so that was what led to the that particular provision in the substitute.
And I think this would probably provide a mechanism for them to make sure that they kept track of that old. So it's probably a benefit to them, I suppose, for tracking where your efforts are going. So thank you, Andy.
Thank you.
Okay, any more questions for Andy? Representative Garra.
Thanks, Andy. This is Representative Garra. I don't want to give up on my the idea that didn't work the last time I mentioned it, which was letting legal services recover full attorney's fees. And so my understanding is the Legal Services Corporation can't recover attorney's fees, so it doesn't work with them. But what about the sort of branch off group that Legal Services has that is allowed to recover or work on the monetary cases? Is there a potential there of letting them recover full attorney's fees?
There could very well be, yes. That's the Alaska Pro Bono Program Incorporated. When the restrictions that Art Peterson mentioned were put on all Legal Services Corporation funding recipients, including ALSC, in 1996, what we found was that while we were running our pro bono program in-house, private attorneys who might want to volunteer to represent types of cases that fell under those prohibitions, and those would include class actions, cases in which were representation is being provided to somebody who's incarcerated, whether it's a prisoner's rights case or not, and representation of certain categories of undocumented aliens. We at that point established the Alaska Pro Bono Program Incorporated as a separate entity precisely so that if there were attorneys willing to volunteer to handle those cases, they wouldn't be blocked by the restrictions on Alaska Service Corporation. So there is no, that the Alaska Pro Bono Program, the attorneys that it recruits to volunteer their time to represent clients, they can recover attorney's fees, and those can accrue to the benefit of the Alaska Pro Bono Program if the, assuming the clients choose to assign their fees. So that might be a very fruitful line of discussion to follow. The Alaska Pro Bono Program has its own, it's a separate staff. Its executive director is Karen Nyquist, who's very capable, and I'm sure she'd be, I'll be sure to pass this along to her, and I'm sure that she'd be very interested in that possibility.
Thanks. Mr. Hankin, I would just ask, if you do follow up on it, I guess I'd ask you to just let me know your thoughts later on. Just call the office or call the chair's office, and then we can think about it further, too.
Thank you.
Hey, thank you. And I just want to let members know there's a strawberry rhubarb pie and chocolate chip cookies behind Representative Guerra to keep you awake.
Witnesses, too, is that?
Yeah, witnesses, too. Witnesses, too, for sure. Russ Webb with the Alaska Mental Health. Russ, are you still there?
Hear an alarm ringing in the background.
Maybe should you go out or?
I'll be quite brief, but I know that.
We could get back to you.
That's fine. Unless you can't hear me, I think I'm okay.
We can hear you.
All right. I'll be quite brief for obvious reasons. For the record, my name is Russ Webb. I am staff to the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. And trustees have asked me to testify on their behalf in support of this bill. Madam Chair, I'd like to thank you for introducing the bill and for your eloquent comments earlier about why some people are less equipped to pull themselves up by their bootstraps and to advocate effectively for themselves in legal matters, essentially why this bill is important. My comments will echo yours. I won't speak to the technical aspects of the bill, but to its purpose and its benefits. Trustees believe that HB 175 would provide the legislature with a good tool for putting to appropriate use the 50% of punitive damages awarded in civil suits that are deposited into the state general fund. The trust supports this because it would help ensure the availability of legal assistance to trust beneficiaries. Those are people with mental disabilities who are eligible for legal services or would be under this legal services from the Alaska Legal Services Corporation because of their low income, which generally results from a permanent disability or a temporary problem that prevents them from working. You spoke to this earlier, people with mental illness, developmental disabilities. Mr. Peterson also spoke to that. Trust beneficiaries are particularly vulnerable and particularly unable to advocate effectively for themselves. They are often in need of legal services to obtain federal disability benefits, VA benefits, access to housing, health, and other services, and to assist them when they need help with consumer issues. They are subject of and vulnerable to discrimination and exploitation, and they are clearly less equipped to be their own advocates and to obtain justice. This bill would help make sure that they get the assistance that they need to obtain benefits or to get justice generally so that help them overcome their disabilities and reduce, in many ways, other costs that the lack of assistance causes to the rest of the state. For instance, instances in which someone's inability to get housing or medical care or other benefits results in a downward spiral in their institutionalization at the Alaska Psychiatric Institute. Those are the kinds of reasons why the trust supports this bill, thinks it's a great idea, and hopes that you pass it. I'll conclude my testimony with that and leave the building, Madam Chair. And again, thank you.
Thank you so much. Good luck out there, Russ. Okay, he's not around for questions. Representative Bloomberg.
Not for him.
Okay.
I'd like to ask a question of Art again.
And we have two more people to testify that have signed up. Why don't I get to them briefly?
Of course.
Marie Darlin with AARP.
For the record, my name is Marie Darlin, representing AARP, and I believe you have received a letter of support from us for this bill. So we just want to say that we think this is one more way of trying to solve some of our fiscal problems, let's say, and so forth. And if we can do that, it certainly, we know, would be helpful to some of our older Alaskans who have some of the same problems and would be able to benefit from this. So, and I would also say that although our membership is 50 and older, we still have kids and grandkids and so forth and so on, and this could have an effect on some of them also. So we do fully support the bill.
Representative Guerra.
Madam Chair, it's one step forward and two steps backwards, and I wanted Marie to hear this because I'm hoping you might be able to activate your membership. The other way we can help senior Alaskans is through the Attorney General's office. And last year we passed a bill that lets the Attorney General's office get full attorney's fees when they win a consumer case. And then this year, in part on that and in part for other good reasons, the governor's office had proposed to add some senior fraud attorneys, attorneys who would represent seniors in fraud cases. There's a dispute in the legislature right now whether or not to approve that request. And it's been deleted, I think, in the law subcommittee. But I'd ask people to think about that as a way also to help low-income seniors who have legal problems, especially in fraud cases. Not related to this bill, but related to the problem. And I'd ask people to think seriously about the governor's proposal to add those attorneys.
We are concerned about that. We are doing a great deal of work on identity theft. And those kinds of situations, which many times affect some of the older population, maybe more than others. And so we are concerned about that and hope that somewhere that will be taken care of, too.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony today and always.
Thank you.
With us. Karen Robinson. And that's all I have. So, yeah.
Yes, Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Karen Robinson, and I didn't write down who I was representing. I actually thought I was going to be representing three groups today, but Russ from the Mental Health Trust obviously was here to testify, but just again want to state from all the trustees that we thank you for introducing this legislation and feel that it's imperative for our beneficiaries to have a program like Alaska Legal Services to get assistance. I'm also here today to represent the Alaska Women's Lobby and also the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. And I'll just be brief, obviously ditto to everything that you have stated, Madam Chairman, and also to Art Peterson for all of his comments. It's obviously quite often it's women from domestic violence situations and sexual assault situations who are needing to get some assistance, and sometimes it may be, for example, a rape victim who wants to get out of an apartment building in which they're in and needs to help just get some legal information on how they maybe can, you know, get out of a lease and move on to another place that they may feel safer. The other thing regarding domestic violence, I'm not sure if a lot of you even realize, but when the original protective orders were passed back in the legislature, back in the 80s, we called it temporary restraining orders at those times, that it was Alaska Legal Services that assisted, primarily was the only agency that could assist women in getting these orders. It was also Sarah Felix, who is now, of course, an attorney general who's been working for government for a very long time, was a VISTA, who actually drafted up all the documents and worked with the courts in getting those documents in place that are now just part of the mainstream of documents that people can go to the court and receive and get the protective orders. I also just kind of want to remind everybody of the work that the lawyers in the state have done regarding setting up the foundation from the late Robert Hendrickson, who was the director of Alaska Legal Services. And for years, there was never a time you didn't see him up here and working diligently to remind all of us. I think, obviously, with his loss was also kind of a loss of, you know, that really strong voice that was needed to remind everybody how important this is. But if you haven't signed up to give dollars to that, it's a very important organization that you should be giving your dollars to. Kind of end, I know that we expect sometimes the lawyers are supposed to just jump in and do the pro bono work that's needed. And I think many of them, as you have heard from all the different agencies out there, whether it's the Alaska Network who has pro bono attorneys or if it's through Alaska Legal Services, that even though quite a few lawyers may be willing to put their name out there to help, they may not have the expertise. I mean, as our lawyer sitting around here knows, that sometimes we expect lawyers to know everything. And if it has to do with the law, you're supposed to be able to answer that question. You're supposed to be able to help us with that situation. The one thing by using people who have committed their life to this field is they have the expertise that's truly needed to help these folks. And that's really important when you're going up against sometimes some more powerful people and who have the money to hire experts in that field. I guess to kind of end, probably for me, Alaska Legal Services definitely holds probably a special little place in my heart. Back in 1976, I came up in May just for a vacation and was walking down the street down here and a nice young attorney walked out. My husband now. He was a VISTA attorney for Alaska Legal Services at one point. I didn't really meet him, though, for another year when he was actually the counsel to the State Affairs Committee. But so we obviously went from about $300 a month to maybe, we hope, a little bit more than by the time I got to start hanging out with him.
Thank you, Karen. Okay, anybody else in the audience that wishes to testify? Anybody else online that wishes to testify? Okay. I know Representative Grunberg has a question.
Yeah, and I would ask Art if he'd come back, and I'd like to ask him to this and to Andy Harrington. Art and I stepped outside, and we talked about an idea. And Art, maybe you've thought about it, and you can sort of flesh it out for Andy and the group.
Through the chair. Representative Grunberg, you want me to flesh out your idea?
Okay, our idea. Okay, we'll do it together. Okay, this was my thought. Having had a little association with Art in a few of his years on the board, we were both on the board together, and I started out on legal services, actually. And Andy, can you hear me?
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, this is Max. Okay. From what Art tells me, and I'm getting a little informal, if I may, here, we have a problem. And one of the problem is, and Art tells me, that before the federal prohibition, Alaska Legal Services was getting under Rule 82, or other rules too, several hundred thousand dollars a year in attorney's fees. But now, according to what Art tells me, the federal law prohibits Alaska Legal Services and any other legal services recipient from, quote, seeking any legal fees. This isn't just with respect to using attorneys funded by federal money, but they can't use legal services attorneys regardless of whether they're funded from federal funds or any other funds legal services has. The thing is that they're not allowed, as I understand it, to file the motion for attorney's fees, basically. Is that basically correct, Mr. Harrington?
That's correct, except that the regulation states that Alaska Legal Services can neither claim nor collect and retain attorney's fees. So even in situations in which a court, sua sponte, says, I'm awarding fees here, we are required to go before that court and file a motion saying we cannot collect and retain this fee.
Okay, well, that being the factual situation, folks, what I thought was conceptually this could be, the following could be done. In any case in which Alaska Legal Services represents the prevailing party, the Attorney General of the state would have the right to seek attorney's fees. The attorney's fees would go into the general fund and could go from the general fund into this little new fund we're creating in the wisdom of the legislature. So the legal services would neither be seeking the fees nor receiving them, but they would go into the general fund, and the legislature could, in its wisdom, under this fund, then appropriate money to legal services.
Would the fees that the AG seeks be based on the attorney time put in by the legal services attorney? Would that be the measure?
Yes.
So the Attorney General would be seeking the...
Either that, or under Rule 82, if it was a contingent kind of an operation, then it would be based on...
We don't take contingent cases. We don't take...
Then it would be based, I assume, on the time. Yeah. But the legal services would not be seeking the fees. And the money wouldn't go to legal service, it would go to the general fund.
I think that's definitely an idea that bears exploration. I would need to search through kind of the general counsel opinions that the Legal Services Corporation has issued and make sure that we're not pushing deadlines that they allow. And perhaps what I should do is to follow through on that separately with your office, Representative Kronberg, and I'll try to do some research on that and we can talk about it more.
Well, what I was wondering, Madam Chair, if that could be done in the next few days and we hold this over the weekend.
You really want to do that?
It's worth several hundred thousand dollars.
I don't. I'd love for you to explore it. I think it's an interesting idea. Les and I have been talking about a variety of different ones. Did you have something to say?
No, I was pointing to the ceiling for Andy's comments.
Okay, got it.
Sorry.
Okay, so Representative... Yes.
It does have a finance referral, so there is time to explore that before it moves throughout a committee if you're not interested in holding it up.
On whatever.
I struggle with it because of all the schemes that the legislature can get involved in. I always fear of pulling a chain through one tunnel and shaking it out the other and saying they're not connected. You know, I'm a little concerned about that.
I think it needs a little bit more work, and we've got a huge schedule next week. I mean, we've got a ton of things up. I would prefer to get this bill. The bill itself is, I think, a great bill. It's a good start, and I'd hate to see it held up for ideas that may never come to fruition. So,
Mr. Harrington, through the chair, I would appreciate if you could get back to Mr. Peterson, myself. We'll see where we can go with this. Anything else?
Okay, with that, brings the bill back before us. Is there any further amendments or committee discussion?
Sure.
Representative Coghill.
I probably prefer the wording now in the UCS for the very last portion of that in the 45 CFR. But I have always been very reluctant to adopt the federal code into our statute because it changes. And we're going to adopt by reference now a statute that we're really going to answer to, though we don't really know what it is. And so equal to or less helps me, but I'm going to work on trying to do that. I understand we're talking about 125% of poverty at the federal level, and maybe that's exactly what we should say. I don't know. That moves. We are of necessity forced to move, and yet nobody ever knows it. And so I always struggle with adoption by reference. And so I'm not going to hold it out of committee, but I wanted to put it on record that I am going to watch that, and I'll be in contact with you on that.
Sounds good. Representative Guerra.
I guess this is a question for the sponsor. And I'm pretty sure I'll be a co-sponsor on this, so it's a question for me, too. But legally, are you allowed to adopt, incorporate a statute that changes in the future, or do you have to incorporate a statute and it can only be the statute as it exists at the time you incorporate it, right? I mean, is following up on Representative Coghill's comment.
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't know the answer.
We've had the revisor, Madam Chair, if I may.
Yeah.
We've actually had the revisor of statutes in the, and many times if they change the part, for example, 1161, and change the qualification part of it, I understand that it becomes a new number. So we might end up with a statute pointing to a repealed or blank section, which we may not know until the revisor statute comes before us, and which could create a technical problem somewhere along the way.
I'd be happy to go back to the original language in the bill, which just basically says as determined by the Alaska Legal Services Corporation. But my concern was folks like yourself, Representative Coghill, that I did not believe would support the bill. So the effort was to try to get it a little bit more defined. But I'm willing to go either way. I think we all get the point. I mean, you want it to be a low-income individual, and you don't want it to be...
That's why it changed.
Yeah.
It's just a suggestion.
Yeah, this was a suggestion that came from somebody else, but beyond that. Whatever the wishes of the committee are, it's not a hanging point for me. Representative Grunberg.
This change, Madam Chair, was as a result of a conversation Mr. Harrington had...
Yes, it was.
With Keith Levy.
But there are folks like Representative Coghill who, if you stick around long enough, you'll hear the conversations, whether it's Denali, KidCare, or other things, about what percent of the poverty level we want to go to. And so it's a legitimate point. It's a very legitimate point. And as to whether or not we want to use a federal standard, maybe we don't. Maybe what we want to do is say 125% of poverty level.
I'd rather us define it than us refer to it. And
do you want to offer a conceptual amendment, maybe, that would allow the drafter to take the substance of...
Madam Chair, if you don't mind, I'd rather do that. And that is just at the 125% of the federal poverty level that we accept in so many other ways here. So that's what this says, 125%. It's 150 under some scales that they have in here. So, but I would prefer to stay at their mean average line, which is 125% of poverty in this 45 CFR.
Okay.
If I may respond to that.
Representative Grunberg.
What this references is the organizations who will be able to access this fund. And legal services has federal standards it has to meet. And for us to be certain that legal services can access this fund, we must reference the federal fund it has to meet, the federal level it has to meet. And if I may, Madam Chair, I'd like to ask Mr. Harrington, what was their, may I ask Mr. Harrington this question?
Yes.
Okay. Andy, what was the reason that Keith gave for making the change concerning the poverty level? I don't understand why he didn't like the language in the original bill.
I'm not sure that here's what he told me was that he thought it was more appropriate for a state statute to reference an existing law or regulation, whether state or federal, than it was to make reference to a federal corporation. I think the language that we had it said something like the eligibility standards is set by the Legal Services Corporation, and he thought it was more appropriate to reference the particular reg than just kind of defer to the corporation. For our purposes, I think that it wouldn't do us any harm to have it expressed in terms of 125% of the poverty ceiling. The one thing that I would say is that, as Mr. Peterson pointed out, the federal government sets a different poverty ceiling for Alaska than it does for the contiguous 48 states, and they allow us to set our eligibility ceilings at 125% of the Alaska poverty ceiling. So if there is going to be a change in the language, I think rather than referring to 125% of the federal poverty ceiling, it would be important to reference it to the 125% of the Alaska poverty ceiling.
If I may follow up.
Representative Grunberg.
Of the three choices, the original bill, the proposed committee substitute, or the language you've just quoted, which do you prefer? Which of those three?
We're fairly on the fence, I guess. The language we would like, the language that will make it most likely to get the bill through and get the governor's signature on it. And that's why we had
filed
to Mr. Levy's recommendation. I think that the only thing we would want to avoid is make sure it doesn't say 125% of the federal poverty ceiling, because that would create some confusion and maybe have us having to not use this money for some clients that would be eligible. I think the regulation is fine, the reference to the Legal Services Corporation is fine, or if it makes Representative Coghill easier in his mind, then 125% of the Alaska poverty ceiling would be fine.
Representative Coghill.
I think the Alaska thing is a point well taken, and I guess I've just seen the revisor statutes enough to know that when we come back, we're continually having to say the federal law changed and therefore we're responsible at this level if we don't do something about it. And it's kind of them wagging us instead of us deciding what our policy is. And so I'm, you know, stickler about it. Probably not as much as I am about special funds, but but in that particular case, I'm not going to argue with you today.
So your conceptual amendment is to
strike the when it means individual income at the 125% poverty level is determined by or 100
Alaska
exactly
25% of the Alaska. Poverty level, yeah. And we'll do it conceptual if that's okay.
And I appreciate you the
drafters
on this. I feel pretty strongly about adopting by reference.
Okay. Is there an objection to the conceptual amendment?
Is that Alaska poverty level or Alaska federal poverty level?
Alaska poverty level. Okay, no objection. Okay, hearing no objection. Conceptual amendment number one has been adopted. So that brings the bill back before us as amended. Are there any further amendments? Okay. Any further discussion? Representative Cott, do you have a motion?
Not to disappoint Art, Madam Chair, I would move that we move out of committee Race of Super House Bill 175 Judiciary as amended. Individual recommendations and
okay. Is there an objection to that motion? Hearing none, as amended. House Bill 175 is moved. Thank you very much. And my apologies to the folks waiting on the next bill. I did tell you this would be quick, and it wasn't. Okay. And thank you, Art. Thank you, Russ. I hope he made it out okay. Thank you, Andy.
He won't answer.
Thank you.
Okay. So House Bill 95, Public Health Disasters and Emergencies. Dr. Munsinger.
Madam Chair and the committee, for the record, my name is Richard Munsinger. I'm the Director of the Division of Public Health, and I would thank you for the opportunity to introduce CSHB 95. What I aim to do in the next 15 minutes or so is very briefly put in context this bill, as to why it's being introduced, what are the problems with our current statutes. We do discuss some elements of the proposed bill and discuss and present some proposed amendments that have come out of the last month's worth of discussions and dialogue with partners and others as the bill has been traversing and moving through the legislature. I think you all have slides in front of you that are a PowerPoint presentation. Hopefully I'm going to talk from that very briefly to present the bill. And slide number 2 has a quote from the Institute of Medicine. Public health is what we as a society do collectively to assure the conditions in which people can be healthy. Madam Chair and Representative Anderson have heard some of this, so hopefully they'll bear with me for the next few minutes as I put this in context. Because what this bill is about is the governmental part of public health. It's not about the private part, it's not about the family part, but it's really about the governmental part of public health, which is important. If one thinks back over the last 150 years, what contributed to the almost doubling of life expectancy of Americans between 1900 and today is things like sewage and sewage removal. This became into the cities in the mid-1800s, safe water. In the middle part of the last century, protection from vaccine-preventable diseases. In the last part of the last century, clean indoor air, mandated removal from the environment of carcinogens, removal of lead from gasoline. All of those things have contributed to improve public health and improve both quality and quantity of life of Americans. Next slide, slide 3, talks about a common misconception is that public health is often, in the public's mind, equated with poor person's health. Public health is really talking about populations. It's talking about prevention. It's not talking about treatment nearly so much. And government plays a really unique role in legal obligations to prevent disease, disability, injury, and illness. Some examples are immunization policies in schools, PPDs for people that are coming into employment in certain occupations, injury prevention work. This winter in Anchorage, there has been discussion in the Anchorage School Board about the partnership. Folks from our division partnered with the Anchorage School District in putting together data for the school board about the basal metabolic rate, or BMI, of kids, and the policy discussions that are now getting ready to get underway in Anchorage about what can the community do about the weight of kids and adults. I often think about public health and use the analogy of fire departments. If we do our job right, we're in the background. Prevention is a big part of what we do. But when there's an outbreak or a fire, we need to be prepared to contain it. And it's a good way to think about this. Slide 4 quickly summarizes the functions in our state that are in the division that I'm responsible for, the Division of Public Health. But I think it's important to remember in our state that there's another part of public health that is also important that's over in DEC, and that's the environmental health part that looks at food and water safety, at air safety, at reasons animals die, etc. Public health law really underpins all of our work. And the reason that we're introducing this bill is to update that underpinning. Slide 5 talks about the public health emergency side, which we've had brought to our attention at Christmas time with the tsunami in Southeast Asia and the 911 several years ago, clearly got brought to our attention, especially with anthrax. Nobody had really thought about the fact that biologic agents or chemical agents could really be terrorist tools. So preparedness is a big part of what we are. It's not a synonym for public health, but it's a big part of what we do. Surveillance is important. A story from Juneau in 1996, on a Friday afternoon about this time, a teenager came into a doctor here in Juneau and had a rash that the doctor thought might be measles. Drew a blood test, gold streaked it up to Fairbanks. Saturday morning, the staff came in. And yes, it was measles. And by noon, they had a phone call down here to Juneau. And over the weekend, they could figure out who the kids had been with, who was immunized, who wasn't. And before this outbreak really got started in the school district, the outbreak could be contained. That's what we do in the background to try and contain outbreaks. As we think about preparedness these days, you've seen in the newspaper articles about avian flu. This is a bird flu that is now been transmitted on numerous occasions in the last couple of years from birds to humans, and over Christmas time, the first indication of the World Health Organization of possible human-to-human transmission. This is a bad disease, 70% mortality. And if and when it mutates and changes and becomes transmissible human to human, containment and ability to quarantine and isolate is going to be really important. We learned with SARS a couple of years ago that we could contain a viral outbreak. Toronto proved that, yes, they got it spread, but they were able to contain it. Same thing in Hong Kong. That's the good news about SARS from a couple years ago, is we've learned that we can, if we have appropriate quarantine and isolation tools, we contain an outbreak, because in many of these diseases, and avian flu would be one of them, drugs aren't going to be very useful. We're going to have to limit exposure is going to be the main tool we're going to have available. Today, we don't have that authority in our state. If I got a call from CDC that somebody was coming from Hanoi on an airplane into Anchorage tonight, and they thought this person had avian flu, we would have to try and convince a judge that our general governmental authorities were enough to quarantine that individual. And it's very unclear with current statutes whether a judge would agree. If you look at slide 6, our weaknesses in our current statutes, number one, have to do with inadequate legal authorities. That's what this bill is about. And problems with our virology laboratory in Fairbanks, HB 100, that has moved and is now on both the House and Senate side in the finance committees. Slide 7 quickly reviews some stories from our past. After World War II, polio and tuberculosis were the most common infectious diseases that we dealt with. And our society in the 50s and 40s was quite accepting of government looking out for their best interest. General authorities were generally pretty useful. Our current statutes date from the 40s. Slide 8 shows some pictures about quarantine and isolation. We don't think about this very often. We don't use these tools very often. In the last 10 years, we've used these tools only a couple of times. But it's tools that are important to have in the background. And if you look at the next slide, on slide 9, this is what we're mostly concerned about. The Centers for Disease Control director has said several times in the last 6 months that she thinks it's not a matter of if avian flu is going to mutate into a human transmissible disease, it's only a question of when, and that we need to be prepared around the world. There's a lot of work going on in Southeast Asia right now to try and contain this disease, but it appears it is now endemic in birds across Southeast Asia. And an article today said in Cambodia that is so poor that it has established itself, just like in southern Vietnam, all over the area. So when it mutates, we need to be prepared. So this bill is about preparedness for us as a society, for us as a state, and to give us those tools that are necessary. Slide 10, as I said, our statutes date from the 40s, from territory days. They've been updated twice. In the mid-90s, there were questions about whether these general authorities were enough for tuberculosis, even though we'd used them for decades, and so the legislature passed tuberculosis-specific statutes. And in 2003, when SARS got to Canada, thankfully the legislature was in session and quickly amended the statute to give us authority to quarantine and isolate for SARS. But those are the only two specific diseases for which we have authority today. Slide 11. So what is in this proposal? It's a statutory framework to support public health mission, services, and role. It gives clear authority for control of conditions of public health importance, and it creates modern due process rights and rules in statute. That's the other part of our current statutes. If we tried to serve you with a quarantine or isolation order and you thought government had overreached, it's very unclear in current statutes what your rights are, what your appeal rights are, and it would be pretty much up to the judge you were dealing with as to how this would turn out for you as an individual. And I think, and we think, that we owe it to the state to have a balance, both to protect the individuals and the public, and to have individuals understand what their rights are if they do think government has overreached. Slide 12, so what is in this act? It defines the essential public health services that have been well established. Institute of Medicine updated this list in the five, 6 years ago again. It describes the state's role, and you can see on the slide the various parts that are in this bill. This bill is the result of several years' worth of work. At the time of 911, there was already some work going on nationally about what should be the emergency powers in a state. After that, that work was rapidly accelerated, and part of that work was incorporated a couple of years ago when the legislature updated the Emergency Powers Act here in our state. Robert Wood Johnson Foundation then in the last several years funded something called the Turning Point Model Act process. Deb Erickson, our deputy director who's sitting behind me here, chaired that national effort. And it developed a model act for states to use to look at their current statutes. Finished about a year ago, starting last summer in depth, we started a process of reviewing our current Alaska statutes against the model act, and this proposal is a result of that work over the course of the summer and fall as a proposal for the legislature to consider. And we have also, this proposal also takes into context our constitution in our state and other laws. Slide 13 just outlines the various parts of the act, and I'm not going to talk about that. It just gives you an outline of what's in the bill. The slide 14 tells you in the various sections, the various authorities and explanations that are in the act. And, for example, in section 4, if you were to look at current statutes, there's language such as crippled children's, which is language that was used in the 40. We don't use language like that. So it takes out outdated language and brings language, for example, up to date. Slide 15 talks about this balancing. I've been using the image in for myself that this is like a balance in a seesaw, that the protecting the public's health balanced against the individual's rights to due process. And the job that the legislature is about right now is to try and find that balance point. And the amendments I'm going to talk about in a few minutes are another attempt to try and redefine that balance in a way out of, that have come out of some of the discussions since the bill has been introduced. So we have constitutional constraints and governmental public health powers, both state and federal. There are constitutional protections of individual rights. There are limitations proposed in this bill, and there are due process provisions. Slide 16 quotes some of the constitutional constraints first established in a Supreme Court decision about 100 years ago this year and reaffirmed in many other courts across the country over the many decades. That there are public health powers are permissible, but only if they're in conformity with these four standards. And a good example might be to talk about AIDS at this point. So we don't, in our country, quarantine or isolate people with AIDS. Why? If one were to look at these middle two standards, reasonable means and proportionality, people that are quarantined or isolated have a contagious or possibly contagious disease that is transmissible to somebody through no act of the other individual, breathing, food, eating, something like this. To contract AIDS, one ordinarily has to engage in some unsafe practice, so there's some individual behavior behind. So if one looks at the proportionality part of this, we in our country have decided that it wouldn't meet the test to quarantine or isolate somebody for a behavior in which there's an individual behavior that contributes to that. And that, just as an example. There's 100 years worth of history and case law now across the country and practice. Another thing I think is important about this bill is that it's not adding new powers. It only is putting a statutory basis behind our current practice that we do as a state and have a track record that we can put forward to the citizens of this state as to how we have acted. Slide 17, I'm not going to read through all the details here about some of the elements in this, about trying to balance individual rights versus the common good. I just want to point out the last bullet on this slide. The Model Act includes the fact that it suggested that states have the ability to impose treatment. This proposal that's before you does not have that authority to impose treatment. As we've thought about it, our thinking is that at the point treatment is a possibility, the individual has a choice. They can choose to be treated and be no longer contagious or possibly contagious, or they can go into quarantine or isolation, and the public's health is protected. The individual has an individual choice to make for themselves. And so the proposal before you does not include mandated treatment. Another thing that has come up in previous hearings has been the suggestion that for religious reasons, a person should be able to exempt themselves from screening or testing. This came up last week in hearings on the Senate side, and we thought about it and talked about it a lot, and we don't think that's a good idea. And the reason we don't is that in an emergency situation where you have an epidemic that's short-lived, if one or two people were to exempt themselves from religious reasons, it probably doesn't matter. There will be enough other people who would voluntarily agree to testing, and we could figure out what's going on. And very shortly, the individual's either going to be better, get cured, or unfortunately have died. In a chronic situation, which is much more our last experience with tuberculosis, if somebody's exposed to TB, chooses not to get tested, we then are left with somebody that may or may not have TB, and it seems to me we would then have an administrative burden of monitoring that person forever and putting that person into quarantine whenever they cough. And that doesn't seem to me to be a reasonable thing to do. Slide 18 just talks about some of the limitations, and I won't comment on that. I want to spend a few minutes talking about the last few slides here. Slide 19 is again a slide about balance of individual rights versus the common good. And the balance the legislature has to try and achieve, find now, is how to let us do the work that is necessary to protect the public's health and yet respect the individual's rights. And that is the hard part. For example, the ACLU has proposed that there shouldn't be any ex parte process in any of the authorities. I'm not a lawyer, as I understand it. If we give somebody a treatment order and they were to refuse, and we think that this person is a risk to somebody, we want to be able to have somebody else besides a state medical officer, we would like to go to court to say to a judge, this person needs to be isolated or quarantined in order to protect the public's health. If this is a Thursday or Friday afternoon, we can do it quickly with a district judge through an ex parte process. The person already knows we're talking about this. We can get an order that day, and the public can be protected that weekend. The person can then clearly is entitled to a hearing, and this bill includes a hearing process, and yet the public's health is protected over the weekend, and a hearing process that could then follow on. If we don't have an ex parte process and we need a hearing before we can get a court order, then our only tool is an emergency order, which is, if you read the proposed bill, is of quite high standard. And whether we can get this done fast and over the weekend, we don't think we could get to a timeliness statute reason. Okay, slides 20 and 21 deal with the amendments that are in front of you that have come out of the last week to 10 days work and lots of discussions over the past month. I just want to talk through them quickly, and then I will be quiet. Amendment number one adds some new standards to the department's ability to acquire and use identifiable health information. You can see the three bullets there. They're in the amendment, and there also is a definition of a public health story, a purpose. I'd like to tell two quick stories. Obviously, a concern of the public is, when does government have the right to get to identifiable health information? Last summer, in July, people started coming off cruise ships in Whittier with what looked like gastroenteritis. It looked like it was probably going to be a norovirus outbreak, which we've had every summer for the last several summers. But by talking to individuals, getting samples and so on, and getting a history, it quickly became apparent that this was an oyster story. And it turned out that what we had was an organism called Vibrio parahemolyticus in oysters, both in Prince William Sound and in Kachemak Bay, had never been cultured north of 61 degrees north latitude before anywhere in the world, and wasn't thought that you had to have a process in place before oysters went to market to assure their safety. A lot of people got sick. We would never have known it if we hadn't been able to, one, do an outbreak investigation, and two, be able to go into identifiable health information. Now, the report that comes out the other side that is used for policy that DEC is implementing for this coming summer's oyster season has no identifiable health information. People's information then, the identifiers are stripped off of it, and we have a report that has numbers of people got sick and where they got sick and what farms were involved and that kind of thing. But that's an example of the kind of work and the balance that's important in public health that we'd be able to do. Another story about public health purpose that one may not think about that are also from the last year. There's several villages up on One River in the interior that all construction was stopped last summer because asbestos was found in the gravel. So there are no standards anywhere in the world to know how much of a risk is asbestos in gravel for outdoor construction. What kind of protection is necessary? Can you use that gravel? So we've been working with that village, those villages, over the last 6 months to try and figure out a plan so DOT and others can resume construction this coming summer. And by doing that, we've partnered with Manelik, have looked at x-rays of everybody over age 50 who's been willing to give us their x-rays, and have sent those x-rays to an outside expert that's an expert in asbestosis, and it's not reported yet, but unofficially I can tell you about 5% of the people over age 50 have signs of asbestosis in those villages. So now we need to go back to those individuals, get a work history, where did they work, and try and figure out a protection plan for those villages as to how they're going to do construction. Another story was in the Daily News earlier this week. If you saw this picture of fish, about mercury in fish and human and fish biomonitoring, we've been working in partnership with Native organizations and people on the coastal villages looking both at human mercury and fish mercury, DEC and us. And we have issued policy statements to the people of Alaska that from the data we have, it's safe to eat fish in Alaska. Mercury levels are very, very low. And the EPA recommendations, especially to pregnant women and children, that they should only eat a small amount of fish isn't appropriate for Alaska. For health reasons, the substitution of fish for something else would be worse, and the mercury levels are very low. If we aren't able to do that kind of work, we can't contribute to that kind of policy discussion. And finally, one last story out of Kivalina. There were stories last summer from an advocacy organization that there was lead that made it such that people shouldn't do subsistence eating in the Kivalina area. So we went in this fall, went into the villages, got people that were interested to have blood drawn for lead monitoring. We've checked, and just like we expected, the lead levels in the individuals is infinitesimally low. The Red Dog Mine has good practices. They cover their loads when they're coming down the haul road. And it's a type of lead that is not easily absorbable. But those are just some examples of policy places where we work in the background that contribute to community discussion. Finally, let's see, do I want to say anything more about any of the other amendments? I guess we'll talk about them when we get to them, probably. And finally, the last picture is my hope is by the time the legislature goes home in May, Alaska isn't the only state in the country on the right without quarantine and isolation authority.
Thank you. Okay, I know we have questions from members of the committee, and we have folks here to testify. The thought is that because we have some folks that are in here from Anchorage that have flown in, and we're getting tight on time, is there any member of the committee that couldn't stay till 3:30? Be a half hour more? That's tough. Okay. So why don't I get to the folks here to testify, and my thought is we'll have questions at the top of the hour on Monday. Okay. Do you want to do that? Okay.
Yeah, I don't know if I'm going to have any questions.
Okay. Representative Dahlstrom does.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'll just pose these questions to you, and then maybe we can address them when you come back. This bill is very interesting to me. Having just worked with DEC Finance Subcommittee, several things came up that pertain to this also. If you could be prepared to comment on how you are monitoring the water standards along with what DEC is doing, and if you feel that that's effective. I'd also like to talk a little bit about the situation we have in our state with having only one medical examiner. And I believe you addressed some of that in one of the amendments I saw, but we have a huge state-of-the-art facilities and one medical examiner, and if he was gone today, I think we would probably have a problem. And I support bringing another person in for that to help him. But also, on the isolation issues, one of your amendments deals with who bears the costs of that, but I'm concerned about the rights and the responsibilities of an employer while someone's in isolation, if you could clarify that. And also the liability that might potentially be there for a person if they choose not to go into isolation.
Oh, also, if a parent, a single parent, or some their two parents were taken into isolation and volunteered to do that, and there was no one to take their children, who would have the responsibility? Would that become an OCS cost they would incur? And if we could just deal with those questions next week, that would be great.
There you go.
Sure.
Yes.
Yeah, Mr.
Representative Guerra, yeah.
I'm going to add to your list just briefly, and we'll talk about more next week. I'm very concerned that the way the statute reads, it will allow the state to quarantine people we don't intend to quarantine. You mentioned people with AIDS, and but the way the statute is written, it allows somebody with an infectious disease, if they impose a substantial risk to public health, that's a person with AIDS. It allows us to quarantine them, and I know we don't want to do that, I mean, unless they're engaging in some sort of inappropriate behavior. I'm not comfortable with the view that, don't worry about the language, the courts won't let us enforce it that far because of the Constitution. I want the language to exclude those diseases that we don't want the law to apply to. So if you could think that one through. Then the other one I'd ask you to think through is if we're going to quarantine, we wanted to do it in the least restrictive means possible. You've mentioned that. There's a line on page 11 that says the department may quarantine somebody in their own home. And I would say that I don't want that to be a may. If the person is willing to be quarantined in their own home, I want them to have that absolute right to be quarantined in their own home. I don't want to give the state the discretion to quarantine them somewhere else. So if you could just take a look at those two issues, that would be wonderful.
Okay.
Thank you. Okay, Pat Center.
Yeah, I'm Pat Center, the chair of the Legislative Committee for the Alaska Nurses Association. And since 9/11 and the outbreak of SARS in Asia, the Alaska Nurses Association has been involved in advocating for better disaster disease outbreak planning. We were very pleased to see the Department of Health and Social Services has taken steps in strengthening their legal authority to respond to these types of public health emergencies. It is imperative that the state's health authorities have in place a mechanism to respond quickly to an infectious disease outbreak. We have read this bill from two perspectives, that of the healthcare provider and that of the affected individuals. We feel that this bill adequately addresses the needs of both these individuals with a few concerns. Our first concern has to do with section 18.15.387, which refers to being able to quarantine and isolate only due to disease outbreaks. But there's also a mention in there, at least in the original bill, of decontamination efforts. We have suggested to the department that they expand this section to refer to situations where individuals are exposed to highly toxic substances that might be transmitted from one individual to another. In this latter case, such as an incident where individuals are exposed to radioactive materials, the department may want to quarantine or isolate individuals just as they would in the case of a disease outbreak. Now, the department has come back to us and said, well, that's under DEC, but I think in a crisis situation, the local officials are going to grab on whoever's there, and if the health department is the person that's there, I'd rather have duplicate lines of authority and not just rely on one agency for that. If we have a dirty bomb go off, you know, panic, and we want to have everybody to have the appropriate authority. Section 18.15.360 states the department may request information from and inspect healthcare records maintained by healthcare providers that identify individuals or characteristics of individuals that, with reportable diseases or other conditions of public health importance. And now we've got the added definition, I think, in the amendment of public health purposes. This section probably concerns us the most because of experiences of healthcare providers in other states where public health officials have been asking and requesting large numbers of private healthcare records on individuals, and it seems to be mostly to advance their own personal political status and not really for public health purposes. We don't, you know, have questions about the current people in place in the health department. But certainly because there's a lot of concern in the healthcare community as a whole about what's going on in other states, we would like this section, the criteria for this to be spelled out as much as possible.
Madam Chair, may I ask one that
Representative
point?
Representative Greenberg.
Have you seen the packet of amendments we have?
I saw an earlier one. I don't know if you have. I have the most recent one.
Well, the one I have is dated March the 3rd.
Okay. Yeah.
You seen that?
Mm-hmm.
The okay. Same amendments. They were just submitted and conformed to this version of the bill.
I see. Okay. My question relates to the First Amendment that's labeled G1. Do you support that amendment, or is that an amendment you don't like?
That my First Amendment.
That seemed to be the one you were just talking about.
Okay. Good. Thank you. They cut me because mine are put together differently.
Yeah, we're not going to be marking the bill up today.
No.
I'd just like to know, and also you mentioned something on 15. 185, or just the one you mentioned a minute ago. Do you have an amendment for that? Because I didn't see an amendment like that in the past.
No, we suggest, yesterday we had suggested this to the department, and I was waiting to see if today if they came through with an amendment, so I haven't drafted one.
I would appreciate it if you could have something drafted so we could see what you want. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I still have a little bit with public health purpose. But we probably should go back with you with a few more adjectives. I would add a few more adjectives to it, would be what my suggestion would be.
Is that something you could get to us in writing?
Yeah, I can do that. Okay. I can send it back to you by Monday.
Fantastic.
Okay. In the last section, there is also a proposed amendment for section 18.15.3850 about the right of the individual to refuse treatment. And there is an amendment in here that relates to this. We, as nurses, we deal a lot with individuals that don't want to take responsibilities for their personal acts. You know, it's not my problem, it's your problem. You deal with it even though they had some control over it. So we had recommended to the department, actually, that they add a qualifier, and I think that's one of your amendments to this section, that if an individual does refuse treatment, then they also need to take on the responsibility of taking those measures to prevent the transmission of whatever infectious disease they are exposed to. And the department has added in there that they should go into quarantine or isolation at their own expense. So we would support that amendment. So we want to thank the department for being so open to our recommendations for changes, and we appreciate the work the committee is going to do as well.
Thank you, Pat. And stay in touch with us then with the other amendments.
Madam Chair.
Representative Gruenberg.
I see two amendments in my packet, G5 and G7, that seem to relate to page 11. Are you referring to both of those, Pat?
No, which one? Okay, you have to say, where are you referring to? Which ones? Which topic? Oh, that's where the G is. Thank you. Let's see, G5.
That relates to the payment of costs. The other one seems to relate to require the person to complete an appropriate prescribed course of treatment. I don't know if you're referring to those or you.
Yeah, I'm referring to the G5 one.
G5, that just relates to the costs.
Yes.
I thought your comments through the chair. Thought your comments were broader than just simply requiring the costs. But were they? Oh, here's something else.
Oh, getting more amendments.
Oh, this is something else.
Oh, okay.
Oh.
Could your? I thought your problems required alleviation more than just payment of some money. But I don't know.
Yes. Yeah. Well, in this kind of, I had not. I don't think I'd seen this one. This one is kind of contradictory to the one before, so I'll have to look at those and get back to
you. Yeah, if you could just get back to the committee, I'd be sure.
Okay, well, it's 3 o'clock. My apologies to the folks who didn't get to online. We will bring the bill back up at the start of the hour, so 1 o'clock on Monday. And if members would stand by, I have something for you really quickly.
I have one question. We have and this is for the doctor, I think. We have a lengthy memo by Jean Michelle dated February 2, and I think that may have referred to the earlier version of the bill. At some point, I'd like to know if any of these problems remain unaddressed, that they've all been taken care of. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.